hppodcraft.com.
What a ripping corridor, I said. Yes, she answered. It's rather nice, but this is nicer, she added, throwing open a big glass door and drawing me forward into what I can best describe as a gigantic greenhouse. Three sides of the place were of glass, through which lovely views were seen. The fourth side was an exquisitely painted landscape of a hayfield and trees stretching away into the distance. For a moment, one scarcely realised whether one was looking at real scenes or painted ones, or where one began and the other ended.
That was an excerpt from the story Outside the House by Bessie Kiffin Taylor. It actually sounds a little like a Vegas casino to me, this greenhouse, like the Venetian or any of those other places
yeah.
they rigged up to feel like the outdoors a little bit.
Right.
In Vegas, it's because there's a brutal desert outside, but there are also lots of dead people buried in that desert, so...
True.
You know, Occam's razor cuts that one two ways. It's either the heat or it's the ghosts. That's yeah. how Occam's razor works. It gives you two options. And nobody knows that better than our guest reader today.
That's right, Marty Jobson. He's doing the reading for us.
Yes.
And he knows science, so he knows all about Occam's razor.
And about the two options it produces every time.
Yeah. He will be appearing at the Cheltenham Science Festival this month. So Ooh. If you want to see him live, do some cool stuff in person, go to his website. We'll put a link in the show notes. It'll tell you how to buy tickets. He's great live. I've seen him do stuff. He's super entertaining, does awesome science. Usually there's explosions involved.
Hey, so when you say live, you really mean live. You can go mm-hmm. see him do this stuff. It's not a virtual event.
No.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, lockdown has been lifted for the time being.
Yeah.
As of the recording, we'll see what's going to happen. For now, yes, he's doing live shows.
Marty is also currently appearing as a guest star in a lot of television episodes in my head.
Yes.
Since that last episode. We talked about Star Trek. We talked about Doctor Who. Marty does some grittier stuff, though, too. I don't know if you know this, but he was in The X-Files as a children's magician who yeah. uses alien technology to produce rabbits.
Whoa.
And of course, these rabbits have their own agenda. At the end of the day, it doesn't help him get any closer to his estranged wife. That takes an intervention from Mulder.
Wow.
And he says, you're doing all this magic, but have you tried just talking to her, Fabulous Jimbo? He says, Jimbo, Occam's razor cuts both ways. And that's sort of the theme of the episode. So watch out for that one.
Oh, boy.
No greater guest star than Marty Jobson.
It's true. This story is from the collection Weird Women 2. And you made a joke about it when, you know, because I called it Weird Women.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, well, I don't think people are going to get confused because there's so few books about women writing weird fiction. But guess what?
Yeah.
There is a collection called Weird Women. And guess who put it together?
Who?
Friend of the show, Leslie Klinger.
Oh. So, yeah, that was, once again, my joke was stupid. And there actually is a desire and a need to clarify. Leslie Klinger, of course, a weird woman herself. If
no.
one only heard of Leslie from that author's first mention on this show. You know, I used the wrong pronoun for our listener, Shoggoth Lord, in a recent comments episode. And she rightly called me out for it. But I would like to point out that we called Leslie Klinger a woman, that might be the first indication that people probably aren't coming here to fact check somebody's pronouns. I do regret it doing that, Shoggoth Lord, but it's also some insight in how to my child's mind works. When people have these handles, I don't imagine the end person who's writing this stuff. I imagine the handle character. So in this case, it's a lord. If I hear that, it's a guy with a bad haircut and hose and bloomers, kind of a Blackadder deal. And he's got two Shoggoths on leashes. And he's riding them around like water skis.
Okay.
It's what any reasonable person would imagine upon hearing the moniker Shoggoth Lord. So I apologize, but that's what I imagine.
The story so far, a World War I vet with a bum leg named John is engaged to a nurse named Elsie. And he has gone to her family's estate ahead of her to meet her family without her and stay with them yeah. until she arrives.
That's the most terrifying part of the story.
Yeah.
Going to stay with somebody's family without them.
Yeah, it's funny because last week you said you were afraid of your family talking to your fiance, telling her things about you. And my yeah. fear is actually the other way around. It's my...
Occam's razor cuts both ways.
I would want to explain to her my family's eccentricities to try and massage those a bit. I'm not worried about me. I'm awesome.
Right.
I just don't want her to get scared away from my family.
The key phrase there is explaining. You would want to smooth it over. You would want this interaction to go well. And nobody has that kind of foresight in this story.
Now, everyone is very nice to him, but when 5 o'clock rolls around, they all go inside, lock up the house. John stays out past five. He has to be dragged in by the butler because there is some unseen force that's making it very difficult for them to go inside. After pushing their way, walking against the wind, as you said, they've made it to the safety of the indoor garden, and that's what we heard at the top.
I was kind of interested in that portion of the story because we're actually talking about moving out of California next year, and one thing I would really miss would be the year-round plants and gardening. I mean, obviously the nice weather, but that you can be, I can be growing what would be summer vegetables.
Yeah.
Year-round here, so, you know, maybe I could just hand this portion of the story over to a realtor. I want one of these. Read page 8 of Outside the House and find something like that.
Mrs. Falconer has John sit next to her. He's really very drained and asks her, why am I so tired? What is with the garden and why was it so hard to get out? She tells him he fell asleep and got a bit stiff. That's her explanation.
Yeah.
And he knows she's lying because he knows he didn't fall asleep, that all really happened. So he just goes, okay, she's going to play it this way. I'll play it this way. Sure. He says, oh, this is a lovely winter garden. And she goes, oh, no, it's the summer garden too after 5 o'clock.
This is the fiance's mother, and it says she's placidly knitting her soldier's socks while doing this, totally ignoring the obvious weirdness. I wonder why anybody didn't just have a simple plan, even if it's like they can't talk about the mystical horror that's happening in the sunken garden. Why don't they just say there's some sinkholes in there, so, like, never go outside. Just stay in the indoor garden the whole time, so that he goes, oh, they just do this because the outdoor garden's broken, or whatever. I know a garden, you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, but people want to go outside.
Because then there wouldn't have been a story, Chad. I don't know who that was.
Kind of Rob Lowe, maybe? I don't know.
It was... Yeah, Rob Lowe. Yeah, that was Rob Lowe. That was mummified Rob Lowe. This funny new character I'm trying out. It's just Rob Lowe, and he's got a bunch of bandages hanging off of him, and he points out that I'm being a jerk.
No, I just think people want to go outside. And why would you want to stay in a house? Our protagonist doesn't want to stay in the house at night. Could you imagine trying to keep him in the house all the time?
Oh, I can imagine it.
Mrs. Falconer leaves and young Bob shows up saying, you'll come in early tomorrow night, am I right? And Bob also mentions that he stayed out too long once before and he got brain fever afterwards.
I hope you won't, sir. I did once, and lowering his voice, I had brain fever afterwards. You won't catch me out after five. That's kind of a big deal, isn't it?
Yeah.
For an under the breath muttering, I had Hodgkin's disease once. I was wondering at that point how seriously I meant to take any of this, actually. Because I'm treating it like this, Bessie was trying to write this rich ghost story. And I don't know, maybe it's not that. It's a little more of a casual magazine story that's got some lightness in tone.
Mm-hmm. When I read it, I enjoyed it. And it does have a sort of lightness in tone, a mystery. It feels more like a society kind of thing as opposed to a horror story. But it's a mystery. And then the end result of it. I mean, this is all very weird. We don't really get an explanation, unfortunately.
And some cool stuff does happen later. I'm being pretty hard on it. And I just wanted to point out that it is entirely possible and probable that the author is having everybody sit around and not talk about the obvious problem, because that is the very element of British society that is being satirized. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not dumb about that. You know, I get it.
The dressing bell rings, which is a thing, and Bob returns to help John to his room.
And he says, I'm not very good at stairs alone. He needs some help. And again, this family's so terrible to just ignore this poor guy. But at least they made some accommodation here in where he's going to stay.
Yeah. His room is on the ground floor, and John goes to open up the window, but Bob says he shouldn't because of the damp. It says, there are three windows in my spacious bedroom, two on one side, one at a queer angle, in a built-out corner. The latter was heavily shuttered, barred up, and padlocked.
So I guess it's because of his condition that they put him in this bedroom that's so haunting adjacent.
Yeah.
But if the decision is, let's not speak of the secret mystery, it does seem kind of stupid.
But it's freaking padlocked.
Right. Because when you padlock something, it makes everybody go, oh, I'm not interested in that anymore. Now that I've seen a padlock on it, that's of less interest to me.
It would stop me.
The padlock?
Heck yeah. I wouldn't mess with it.
You gotta watch this thing, Lockpicking Lawyer, man. You can get through a lot of padlocks with just a little hammer. because there's a simple latch in there. Or you use a little hook. I'll talk to you about it.
So the kid says that the windows are opened until 5 and then they're closed up. The windows look out onto the lawn. Then Bob creeps away. John decides that it would amuse him to wind these folks up and try to get around whatever it is that they're trying to hide. I have a firm and fixed belief that the quickest way for a sick person to become a well one is to keep the mind occupied, busy, interested, to fill up the days and hours, leaving no time for brooding or speculation as to the why or wherefores of one's apparent slow healing. Thoughts of health bring health just as quickly as brooding melancholy brings depression and subsequent ills in his train.
That's pretty good. Why did you pick that out?
Well, I thought it was interesting because there is some truth to it, but it also doesn't work for some people. Some people can't just be positive, be able to help their mental health. If their feelings bad, sometimes they feel bad and looking positive doesn't work. But for some people, it does. Like if you just keep yourself busy and you keep yourself occupied and you're doing things that you will find, for me, that's how I get happy. If I find myself getting depressed or down, which happens from time to time, I find the more that I work, the more that I read, the more that I'm doing things, those kind of keep my brain from going into those dark places.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, that's what's gotten me through the last year and a half. It's just been being extremely occupied. But as you say, I have also been in the position where, hey, I got dressed today was a pretty big accomplishment.
Yeah.
You know, so sometimes it's occupying yourself is not, I mean, there's obstacles to getting there, mm-hmm. but it is the better thing to be doing, because if you do allow yourself time to wallow, even though sometimes you need it, it can just make things worse. It put me in the mind of that Alec Guinness gun show, The Bridge on the River Kwai. You know, that cheesecake Alec Guinness movie. He commits his men to building a really good bridge. The Japanese are ordering them to do it, and he says, why don't we show them what the English can really do? And as a result, they have pretty good morale, and they make it through that prison camp.
Yeah.
But it's also a downfall, because he has so much pride in it that at the end he doesn't want to blow it up. I just recently watched that movie, is my point.
Yeah.
We should keep going with the story.
So he gets dressed and is surprised no one is coming to take him to wherever he's supposed to go for dinner. So he wanders around, he manages to find everyone, and they're all chatting, and then they're called into the dining room. The dining room is not at all old and somber, but it's painted bright colors and decorated with lots of flowers. They eat, don't talk about the garden, go back to the indoor garden for some smokes and games, and around 9:40, John wants to go out and have a smoke. But everywhere in the house, all the windows are locked up. His father-in-law-to-be sits down next to him and suggests that he turn in early. John says, no thanks. And then he adds, it would really be nice to have windows of glass to look out of. Must be a great view. But Mr. Falconer says, well, not after 5. It would not be a good view. And then he just buggers off. Now, he wanders around a bit when Maud asks him to sing with them, and then he turns her down and saying that he wants to go outside for a smoke. So the whole room goes silent, and everyone looks shocked. Mrs. Falconer says, John, as my future son-in-law, I ask you not to leave the house tonight.
Son-in-law of the future!
But he says, I'm sorry, Mrs. Falconer, but I see no reason to comply with such a curious request. I am a soldier accustomed to be out and about in all weathers. I am not a hot house plant, and if I do not breathe some fresh air, I shall neither rest nor sleep. My little evening walk is my best sedative, and I must ask your kind indulgence of my whim. Fresh air I must have. And the only person to reply is Bob, and he says, if you can get it fresh, sir, it would be all right. John leaves miffed. He tries to find the door out, but he can't find any of the doors that lead out of the house. So he gets frustrated and he just goes to his room.
You know, speaking of one's room and escaping, this is another insight that I had while I was reading this, and my mind drifted a bit. Because lately we were rearranging in the bedroom, and I forgot I have this old pair of shoes under the bedside table.
Uh-huh.
Sort of like those shoes you keep to mow the lawn in, right?
Sure.
There's some running shoes. I was going to donate them or throw them out. And Heather said, why don't you keep those? Because if something goes down and we need to throw on clothes real quick, keep them under the bed side table there, and then you'll have them if there's an earthquake or who knows what.
Sure.
Similarly, I have a set of clothes like that in the car, right? Like if you break down, you have this extra set of clothes, and those are clothes that just almost got thrown out, but we thought, let's save them for this. Yeah. As I was sitting there with the story on my lap, I thought, why do we pick those clothes for the one time when your outfit is probably not going to change for a very long period of time? And like you're going to look like Pulp Fiction after they cleaned up the body in this situation, instead of, you should be straight flexing, man. That outfit should be the best thing you have.
Yeah.
Especially if it's like some post-apocalyptic kind of situation, what you look like at the beginning is going to mean a lot. So if everybody else is looking sloppy, Six Flags-like, and you show up and you've got an array of belts around your chest and some mm-hmm. cool cargo pants and yep. maybe some wristbands and fingerless gloves and stuff. Right away, you're going to get respected as a leader. So when they found out I'm a podcaster, they won't kill me because I would have already made that credible first impression.
Exactly. They won't know you're a podcaster. They'll assume you're some kind of turbo or ozone mm-hmm. and that you're going to show them how to survive in this world. Makes sense.
And maybe how to, you know, reconnect with their estranged wives.
It's all coming together.
Just talk. Just tell them the truth.
John is so obsessed with these windows and wanting them open that he decides that tomorrow he is going to find a file and file off this padlock to get out. And that's going to show them, which is pretty nuts.
Yeah, especially when he could just use a hammer, like I explained. But YouTube wasn't around then.
No. Now, the following morning, Maud, his soon-to-be sister-in-law, and her fiancé, Captain McLean, are going into town, and he invites himself along with them.
I can't remember what the story was or if it's been a few of them, but it seems like there's always a trip into town around this period of time where our hero buys a gun or some gunpowder or pipe bombs or something like that. So this is that beat.
They offer to get what he wants for him, but he insists to go, and they're English, so they can't say no to him.
Yeah.
We got some third wheel action going on here. Plus, everyone is really annoyed with John because he's not playing ball about the weird house rules. In the village, John's able to slip away, buy three metal files, and hide them in his pocket.
It's a good thing he got three. That's really key to the resolution of this story.
So they got back before lunch. Mrs. Falconer told him that tea would be on the lawn, the low lawn, at 4, and we are all going to come in at 5. So John goes to his room to get the lay of the land to make his plans for escape. He doesn't think he's going to be able to do the filing now, and he's going to have to wait until later. Plus, it may be locked from the outside as well, so he's going to have to go have a nosy to see if that window is accessible.
Nothing builds momentum in a story like having a scene in which the hero decides to wait to do something later. It kind of creates a tension where I want to go do something else instead of read the story. You know what I mean?
At 4, he joins everyone on the low lawn and gets the young fella Bob to help him walk a bit to stretch his gamey leg, and Bob is up for it. As time gets close to 5, John notices that the little kids are going first. They get them in the house by offering them some fruit from the inside garden. Then Maud McLean goes in after, and then Mr. and Mrs. Falconer are sitting around, so John just decides he's going to go and make a show of going in. He goes in, but then he circles back out, and everybody's inside now, and he finds himself pausing, not because he wants to, but because he feels he's compelled.
And then he goes right for it. He walks to the sunken lawn.
I'd been once in a gas cloud in France, but this wasn't like that. This was like nothing. I struggled a few more yards and gazed. The house seemed to have receded. The lawn seemed further below me and appeared veiled in a bluish haze. Thicker and thicker it seemed to get, and as I gazed, I fancied I could discern swiftly hurrying forms moving to and fro. I struggled on again, intent only on reaching the house. As I advanced, the bluish fog closed round me, shutting me in an impenetrable wall. In vain I struggled, in vain I peered, at last even beating the fog with my hands, as if to force a passage through. Nothing availed me, and ever and anon I could see the hurrying forms below me. Terror struck me. Would that I were safely in the indoor garden with its warmth and light and beauty instead of here, enveloped in fog with other forms of which I dared not think, hurrying below me. Would that I had been guided instead of going my own obstinate way. Vain were such repinings now. The shapes seemed more defined, the atmosphere more dense. Feebly I struggled to see the time by my luminous watch. 8 o'clock. Have I been wandering here so long? It seemed incredible. I must and will reach the house. But now, I seem to have lost the house. All trace of it had vanished.
That's cool.
Yeah, I agree. I really liked that passage. And I thought, oh man, all those times I laughed at mimes doing Walk Against the Wind, this is what they were going through internally.
Oh no.
How dare I make fun of them? No, but I did. I really liked this. From here on to the end, I actually really liked the story. I just got bored with the windup.
I understand that. The fog gets more dense, but as he moves nearer to the sunken lawn, it looks incredibly deep, like he's standing on a cliff with shapes moving around below. A figure seemed to come close to me, out of the void, stretching its arms towards me as if to drag me with it. I saw no face, no definite shape beyond the shadowy outline and the arms. Now he finds himself moving back away from it into the bushes. In the fog, he loses his bearings and he's not sure where he's at, and then he hears somebody calling him, but he can't answer because he's freaked out. He pushes back and falls, closing his eyes. And when he opens his eyes, Mrs. Falconer is there with some brandy in one hand and a rug in the other, and this huge hound on a chain. And she asks if he can walk, and he asks, are we far from the house? And she says, the house, as far as we are concerned, has ceased to exist until daylight. That's crazy. So it's like some sort of weird dimensional thing? Is like they've been pulled into another world, or?
Well, no. I mean, that's the way that she's positioning it to him, but I don't think that's the case.
No? Because they're just in this fog, and they can't get to the house. For whatever reason.
Yeah, I mean, it's just you won't be able to, I think, is all she's saying. For all intents and purposes, just pretend it doesn't even exist because we'll never get there until there's light.
So she admonishes him for not following the rules, but he thanks her for coming to get him. And she says, no one else can. Only Gellert and I can come. And Gellert is the dog.
Why? Do you know?
Nope.
I mean, was that something that in the story, I just wondered if I missed it?
No.
Why it's only her and the dog?
Maybe she is sensitive and can navigate it and won't get pulled in by it, or her and the dog together are enough, because the dog seems to be immune or can protect against this stuff in some way.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't explain it. Now she helps him move away from the shrubs and into a meadow where his strength gives out and he falls. She tells him he's got to keep going. The hound starts to growl as she finally helps him through a gate and they end up near a road. And then she finally says, oh, thank God. And John, he just passes out. When he wakes up, his head is on her knee and he's covered by the rug and the sky is starting to brighten. It's morning. She's all business. She doesn't address what happened to them. She says that he will enjoy a bath and sleep, ordering him. He is very, very tired, almost drained, and feeling very ashamed for having put this woman through all of this.
I thought this part was interesting. It says that I had seen things not of this world in the ordinary meaning of the word, I was well aware, nor was I unduly fearful of them. The horror lay in the suffocating fog and in the apparent wish to haul me into some abyss. I was not afraid of mere forms. Some of us out in no man's land were not unknowing of other forms being present as well as our comrades in the flesh. That was interesting. Yeah. There are those of us who, in spite of the jeerings of scoffers, still say that the angels of Mons were not the fantasy of unhinged minds, nor even a mirage due to a tot of rum. Therefore, I, among many others, have learned to be less skeptical and not to take non-understandable things as impossibilities.
Hmm.
And this was a reference to something we've discussed before. I think the angels of Mons are partly the result of Arthur Macken's story, The Bowmen, which was an accidental hoax about supernatural intervention in the war. But the ideas presented in that paragraph were so interesting. I kind of wish there had been more exploration of that. Idea that there were, it made me think of Baltimore a little bit.
Mike Mignola.
This is the book in the series of graphic novels where there are vampires out in the no man's land with them. And, you know, I thought that stuff was pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's really cool. When they get to the house, she takes off her coat and tells John, when you have had food, John, I advise a bath, bed, and a still tongue. The household are aware you remained outside. What you had better have been in. Details of your experience are not desirable, and for Elsie's sake, I do not advise repetition of foolhardiness. I also ask you to conform to the house rules, which are made as little irksome as possible. He does what he's told, has a bath, and he goes to bed, and he sleeps until about 10 a.m. After he awakens, it's time to pick up Elsie. They go and get her. She greets him warmly, but she admonishes him. It seems that her mother telegraphed her to come back right away.
Right, so she's coming a little in advance of when she was even going to show up because he's not playing by the rules. But at least she's finally here to try and shed some light on this situation.
He tries to get Elsie to tell him what's going on, but she won't or can't. She says, never mind trying to fathom things. Others have tried before you. Promise me you will not think of it anymore. But he doesn't promise not to think. He does promise not to go out after 5. When they return, they are never really able to get any alone time. Later, when they're all hanging around, Miss Dorcas, the governess, seems to John like maybe someone who might spill the beans. So he invites her to play some putt-putt. And she knows about last night. So he tells her he's not going to repeat last night's activities. And then they get interrupted, but she whispers to him, look in the books on your shelf tonight. And he's like, oh, okay, I'm getting a clue here. This is exciting. So that night, back in his room, he finds a little book with a note in it. And on the pages, it says, "You have given a loophole and are waited for. Take care you are not taken outside the house. Keep from your windows, JD." I would heed that he's not, he's going to not open up his windows, you know? And then he goes, well, yeah, I'm not going to open up the windows, but I do want to peek. I just do want to do a peek. So that's fine. Just peeking is going to be okay. So he takes off his coat. He gets the filing. He stops to rest and he thinks, if this is actually dangerous, maybe I should make a record. So he starts writing everything down for his old buddy, Captain Percy Hesketh.
So the character does pay off. At least, you know, he's going to conclude the story because I made a crack about him not being of any use. I actually meant that their whole plan for him to speak to each other after death or whatever. But the character does show up again, which I was glad about.
Well, he finishes off the story for us because obviously something bad's going to happen to John here. John gets back to his filing. He gets the lock off. And just as it opens a bit, it creaks so loudly that he expects he woke the whole house. And then the shutter slams open, crack. And his last bit is, "I dimly remember calling Percy, calling with my soul more than with my voice." So the next thing he remembers is being in a hospital with Percy Hesketh there. He says he has John's papers and he wants to know what followed the cracking. John tells him that there was an unearthly glow, faces pressed up against the window, gaunt and creepy, looking like living skeletons, flesh pulled over tightly. They were able to grab him and pull him down to the low lawn.
Yikes.
Now the narrative changes to Captain Hesketh. He says that was the last coherent thing John said. And he brought Elsie into the hospital, but he didn't even recognize her. Another visit that he talked about didn't seem to know who he was himself. He says, "I'm not John. I wish my brains wouldn't keep running around and around like a glass ball full of colors. I could listen to people if the glass ball would keep still. Hark, there are guns at it again. Are they? Give me my rifle. I'll show them. Now, boys, come on. Over the top and at them." After that, he died. It was almost 3 years after the incident.
Yeah, I will say I didn't expect him to go totally bonkers crazy. I thought he'd have a ghost interaction and that would be it. But this thing ruined him and he died, and he's 39 years old. He passed away because he went crazy. Didn't remember his fiance, anything. I mean, it just wiped him out mentally.
Yeah. And I wish the story ended there. That feels like a good, weird story. Like, what the hell was that? What were these people up to? Nobody has any answers, but we get the wraparound from Captain Hesketh. It makes it more like a ghost story and less of a weird tale. Captain Hesketh goes to the inn at the village by the house. Old Falconer, the grandfather of Mr. Falconer, was a greedy jerk. He had lots of coal mines in the area and one that was very close to the house. It was dangerous to keep mining there, but he didn't care about the workers. He wanted them to continue. He wants his money. He wants coal. There was a cave in, and that's why the ground is sunken in near the house. He thought it would be too costly to dig up the dead guys. 400 men were down there, but of course, they weren't dead. Or they think they weren't dead because they could hear groans and shrieks.
God, so it's like a mass buried alive incident.
So when the old man died, he passed on the dire legacy of his sons, leaving them the whole of his fortune on the condition that they lived in the house, making the promise that none on the premises would be out of the house after 5 PM, stating that the entombed men haunted the place. It is said that the miners had slowly starved to death and could have been rescued at the time, but now haunted the place, intent upon finding victims to drag below with them. So with John, after the window came open, Falconer came in, saw him being dragged away, and sent out the dog. The dog saved him from being pulled underground into the underworld, but his mind was shattered, and this is how the story ends.
"Major Longworth died in the hospital here, sir," went on my garrulous host, "and Miss Falconer entered a nursing sisterhood. People say the house will collapse someday. Have a look at it, sir, if you've time, before it gets late." I thanked him and went my way. I found the house desolate and dilapidated, the vast glass house on one side of it full of dead plants and broken chairs, dirty beyond description. The gardens were a tangle of briars and weeds. The paths had become mere grass tracks, the low lawn grown rank and rough, its greenness marred by a vast blackened crack right across it, as if a subsidence had taken place. A brooding sense of mystery and disaster hangs over the place. Nor do I hesitate to believe when I hear on all sides how the place is shunned. Still less can I doubt my friend's written words of all that befell him, in spite of all warnings to conform to orders and not venture outside the house.
So the reason that nobody could speak about it was because the shame of having done this is what prohibited them from doing it, like in a legal sense, right? The old man said, you can't speak about this at all. So I guess that's the reason they can't. But all the more reason why you would think they'd have a set of excuses to keep people from doing it.
Yeah, I mean, it could be something as stupid as like some gas leak that happens at 5 o'clock every day. It just... It comes out of the ground. It's poisonous. You don't want to be anywhere near it.
Yeah. Or there's like a lady over there that walks by and gives out mean looks. You don't want to be at the receiving end of one of those. Anything. And then you have this sort of poltergeist ending.
Yeah. It is sort of a poltergeist ending. Now, some of the themes of this in that Weird's Women 2, they talk about the idea of inside and outside. You know, the outside, everything appears to be normal. But the inside, there's these problems, and it could be a reference to the war, how people come back from the war and they've got all this post-traumatic stress disorder that they're dealing with, but they're seeming like they're okay and they're trying to get back to their normal life. You know, those types of parallels. There was a lot of stories at this time period written by women about the war and about the men coming back from the war and how they've faced these terrible horrors. And they were changed, and it affected a whole generation of people, and so many people just didn't come back as well.
Oh yeah, I mean, you know, it's a little back to our point, back to our discussion about just sort of getting busy to avoid depression.
Yeah,
I mean, that's a microcosm of what the story is, right?
Yeah,
we're trying to have these garden parties and go along and do things as we always have, and just completely ignore the 400 buried men outside and how horrible that was, and not process it. Mm.
I know you didn't enjoy the story, but I did. I thought it was a good read. It's got problems. It's a little slow. But overall, I liked it.
Well, like, I think I prefaced this whole thing in the first episode by saying, you know, why bother ranking these things?
Yeah.
The story comes and it does what it does. And so, yeah, I don't mean to say don't read this or that it's bad. I just didn't really enjoy it. Being somebody who's read a lot of ghost stories, because to be honest with you, the thing that we just said, that theme, that's all ghost stories, really. So what I expect is for it to be a yarn that's going to really draw me in on top of that theme, because the theme in and of itself isn't very novel. Yeah, a lot of this stuff was coming out around this time, rightly so. It's a devastating world incident that's going to lead to people writing traumatic ghost stories. But, you know, I want it to be more arresting than this one was. Hey, sure. That's what happens when you just cribbing stuff out of these compilations. You're going to run into some that, you know, we differ on opinion in.
Yeah, that's great.
It was still worth reading.
We usually don't differ.
I would read more by the author.
I find it refreshing that I actually liked a story that you didn't.
You find that refreshing. You wouldn't like it the other way around.
No, that would piss me off.
Yeah. You're like, you know what? I'm realizing that I like it when I take pleasure in things, but the pleasure is all the sweeter when it also makes you mad. I just like enjoy it more.
Well, the shoe fits. I want to thank Marty Jobson for being a great reader. He really brought this stuff to life. Make sure you check him out. Go to his website, martyjobson.co.uk, and see all of his rad shows, live things. He's got a bunch of stuff on YouTube you can check out. Marty is a treasure.
The best of all special guests. And I'd also like to thank some patrons for supporting us. I want to start by thanking Martin John Ryan.
I'd like to thank Thomas Lehman.
I'd like to thank PR Brewer.
Robin, thank you.
I'd like to thank Ed Ross.
Jacob Hill, thank you very much.
Joshua, thank you.
Andrew Hetzel, thank you.
Joaquin Sun, thank you.
And lastly, Jonah Bensian, thank you.
Next up, we're going to have a story called The Blackstone Statue by Mary Elizabeth Councilman. That's a name, not a title, huh?
Yes.
It's from 1937. I'm looking. Yeah, that sounds good. All right. You've read that one?
I have not read it. I'm looking forward to reading it, though.
Well, Black God's Kiss, Black Destroyer. I'm looking forward to a Blackstone statue. It's a good trend so far.
And with that, I'm Chris Lackey.
I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And you've been listening to HP Podcraft.
Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
HPPodcraft.com.